Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now former Democratic National Committee Chair Donna Brazile. Her book, Making Lots of Waves Inside the Party, is called Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. You've heard how it has renewed talk of the primaries being rigged for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders, and how the Clinton campaign failed itself in the general election, despite Brazile and lots of other insiders warning them about their strategy. So, Donna, thanks for making this one of your stops. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to hear your voice again. I listen to you all the time, even when I'm not in the vicinity. So thanks for having me back on.
I'm so glad to hear that, Don. And let's clarify first, before we get to the good news about yesterday's election, you're saying that you went looking to see if the primaries were rigged, and you determined that they were not, but what you found broke your heart. Can you unconfuse our listeners about that?
In the book is actually chapter 10, and the title of this chapter is Bernie, I Found the Cancer, But I Won't Kill the Patient. As you well know, I've been a Democratic operative for about 40 years of my life, and I promised Bernie when I took the position of interim chair of the DNC that I would get to the bottom of whether or not Hillary's team had rigged the party process in her favor so that only she could win the nomination. I'm reading directly from my book. I went on to say that I had tried to search out any other evidence of internal corruption that would show that the DNC was rigging the system to throw the primary to Hillary. But I could not find any in the party affairs or among the staff. I had gone department by department investigating individual conduct for evidence of skewed decisions, and I was happy to see that I had found none. Then I found this agreement. So what I tried to explain, and sometimes we don't always spell it out like ABC, but it was to essentially say that it wasn't the joint fundraising agreement, a standard agreement that many other candidates in the past, John Kerry in 2004 when he became the nominee, Barack Obama when he became the nominee in 2008. Back when I was Al Gore's campaign manager, we didn't have these form of agreements. This was post-McCain-Feingold and campaign finance reform. And so what I found was an additional agreement that was not the standard joint fundraising agreement that gave the Clinton campaign control over basically three different functions of the Democratic Party: the communications function, the technology function, and the research function, in exchange for helping us get out of a massive amount of debt, which we did have after the 2012 campaign and 2014 campaign. The Hillary Clinton campaign put us on what I call a starvation diet. Now, they have every right, as I said, while it wasn't illegal, it was in my judgment, it was unacceptable. It prevented me from doing my job as chair of the party. I called it a cancer, and the control of the Clinton camp had over the DNC made it difficult to do my job as chair. So I hope that clarifies that I was not referring to, as Donald Trump often would say on the campaign trail, that the system was rigged. The system that we elect our candidates by, where voters here in New York or Connecticut or New Hampshire, those primary processes are managed by the state government. We do, as a party, manage the caucuses and work it in collaboration with our state parties. But I wanted to make sure that everyone understood that Hillary won the primary fair and square. She not only received 4 million more votes than Senator Sanders, the majority of elected delegates, 9 out of 10 African Americans voted for her. She won 3 out of 4 contests. Bernie ran a fantastic campaign. It energized the party. He brought new people into the process. He participated as a Democrat throughout the primary and the general election. I believe that Bernie and many of his supporters, and many of them are my colleagues on the DNC, they did a fantastic job overall in trying to heal the party post-convention, and it was my duty and obligation as the chair of the party, as I state in the book, my duty and responsibility was to go back and take an internal look, a forensic examination, and to ensure that no one ever takes over the party functions, any functions ever again during a primary. Mm.
So, listeners, your calls for Donna Brazil are welcome about her book or about yesterday's election results or the future of the Democratic Party going into 2018 and beyond. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So the big thing you found was this financial arrangement, as you've been saying, where the Clinton campaign, which was flush, was helping to fund the DNC, which was in debt, and the Clinton campaign had lots of control over the party's actions. So I want to ask you, why is that bad? Because I know Clinton loyalists who are saying, so what? Because if the Democratic Party thought its best chance at winning the election was to favor Clinton over Sanders in the primaries, the party is actually doing its job, because its job is to win the presidency, not to be mindlessly neutral. Do you buy that argument at all?
Look, as an officer and an activist in the Democratic Party, I do believe that the independence of the DNC was jeopardized, and that was wrong. And the word I used was cancer, because you don't take over any functions of the party prior to securing the nomination. I found no evidence. I mean, the communications department, the person that was hired, did not go out there and speak on radio or television on behalf of the Clinton campaign. The research department primarily focused on Donald Trump and the Republicans and getting ready for the fall campaign. Technology began to upgrade our system. But look, this was even before we knew that the DNC was being hacked by the Russians. And that department and the resources that the Clinton campaign eventually did provide was enable us to do remediation once we found out. So in the book, I stipulate that while it was not illegal, I found it unethical to put the party in that position. I have to applaud the staff who signed the agreement, because they made sure that none of the resources went into the states prior to the primary being over, or none of the money was spent or used to advance one candidate over the other. My job as party chair was to go in and make an assessment, and I did that by bringing in somebody who worked with Howard Dean in 2004, who knew a lot about these joint fundraising agreements, and I brought in others inside the party who could help me ensure that the DNC was functioning properly once I became chair.
Judith in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Donna Brazil. Hi, Judith.
Hi, how you doing? And this is what I would say. I really respect Donna Brazil. I've looked up to you since you first, appeared on the scene with Al Gore. But I have to tell you, I am really disappointed that this stuff is being brought up at this time. So I'm going to ask you, what is it that you think ought to be done at this time to unify the party? And, look, Bernie's not even a Democrat, okay? He is an independent. So I just am bewildered that we are squandering the opportunities that we have at this time to really take back the House and the Senate. I mean, I just think that the timing of all of this discussion, we should not be relitigating what happened in 2016. That's my position. I'll take your answer off the air.
Judith, thank you so much.
And thank you, Judith, for all that you do and others do to not only help elect Democratic candidates but protect our democracy. You know, I've been told that this is the wrong time to tell troubling truths. Imagine if this book came out next year before the midterm elections, or the year after when the 2020 cycle will begin. The year after a presidential election, in my view, is the best year for debate and dissent. I had to relive what I experienced in the hope that nobody else has to experience it again. I am a party faithful to the party. I started at the age of 9. There's probably no one on the battlefield today that has spent more time in the trenches all across this country 49 states, 7 presidential campaigns, 56 congressional campaigns. I didn't come on the scene with Al Gore. I became campaign manager because I was out there in 98. I was out there in 96. Go all the way back to 1976. That's who I am. This was a wound in our party. And the only way that you heal an open wound is to address it. We need to discuss what happened, all of it, so that we can heal and unite and move forward stronger. I respect those who believe that it was inappropriate, perhaps, to raise this. But if we don't change it, if the party cannot function by changing its the way it behaves, then we're going to, these doubts will be raised again. I want to say one thing on behalf of Tom Perez and the new leadership of the Democratic Party, including Michael Blake here from New York and many, many others, Grace Meng also from New York. They are making changes. The Unity Commission is comprised of both Sanders and Clinton delegates. And while Bernie is going to run as an independent and next year in his reelection, let me say that many of the people who came on board, they are Democrats. They are lifelong Democrats. They got as much skin in the game as I've had in the game. I respect their voices. I respect their participation. This is not about Bernie versus Hillary versus Martin versus Joe versus anyone else. This is about the future of our country. And if we're not able to have a conversation about what happened, then I'm afraid that we will make this mistake again. I got to add one more thing, Brian.
Yep.
But you know, I'm a fighter. Last night, I was so proud. I was proud. I was proud not just of the people here in New York who came out, New Jersey who came out. I was proud of the people in Virginia who went out and rain. I was proud of people in Maine, North Carolina, Georgia, all of the places we flipped last night. I'm proud of the grassroots Democrats who are going to help this party come out of the wilderness. Last night, the victory belongs to the grassroots Democrats.
So you're trying to unify everybody, obviously, but you keep using this strong language that is leaving people feeling divided, like it's a cancer, like what you found broke your heart. Even chapter 12 of your book, you compare your treatment by the Clinton campaign to Patsy the Slave from 12 Years a Slave. Because you're African American, that suggests to people's minds, at least, a racial component. Did you mean it that way?
Let me say this. On August 19, Donald Trump went into a black church in a black neighborhood, and he said, "What the hell do you have to lose?" I don't know if you recall that.
I do. He said it
and
a lot.
And for me, I'm sitting in my office in Washington, D.C., and I'm like, uh-oh, he is trying to divide the black vote. Now, by the way, I didn't know at that time that Facebook and Twitter and everybody else had black activists and others stoking the flame, so to speak. But at that moment, I'm like, I got to respond. The party needs to respond. I don't care if I'm black, white, blue, green, or purple, but I wanted to respond. And when I was told to sit down and not respond, I said, well, at least I could write a column. You can't take away my voice. I could not spend money that I felt the DNC was raising. The DNC had money. I wanted to spend it. And when I was told that all I could spend was $2 million, not the $8 million that I wanted, I rebelled.
Why didn't
they? Yes, I rebelled. And so I call that chapter, Brian. It's a little bit, look, you ever heard of words, the two words, tough love? It's tough love. I wanted to respond, because, and it's all in my book, and I hope people will read it, because there's a lot of good lessons to be learned. I responded by going out and raising money. I responded by going out and recruiting more people to help us. I responded by encouraging those who could spend their money to raise more money for the Democratic Party to fight back.
What?
This party is coming back, and it's coming back stronger for 2018, 2020, and beyond.
Why didn't they want you to respond to that?
Because they felt as though they had a better way of dealing with it. Remember, this was their campaign. I was not managing Secretary Clinton's campaign. I supported her campaign. I wanted to help her. That's why I became chair. I became chair because I wanted to help her win. This was the second time I had become chair of the party. I often tell my friend I am not the person they call on to manage things, but I'm always the person they call on to clean up the mess. And so I wanted her to win. I wanted her to win as much as I wanted Barack Obama to win in the fall of 2008. And I was putting everything I had on the table. And I got frustrated and disappointed that my friends felt as though they had to control the resources that I thought it should properly have been in the purview of the DNC. The DNC is an independent entity, independent of the candidates and the campaigns who are quote-unquote running. And I felt as someone who has put my name on a lot of loan agreements and a lot of paper to raise money for the Democratic Party, that I should have had a say in how the money was spent.
Michelle in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Donna Brazil. Hi, Michelle.
Hi Brian.
Michelle.
Hi, Donna. So I'm a black woman. I was a Bernie Sanders supporter. And Donna, I think I'm so, like, excited in some ways that we're having this conversation, but there are some things that are really painful and I think need to be discussed and really can't be reconciled within this sort of narrative about the funding agreement, which is primarily the issue of the questions, right? Before these town halls in March of 2016, these two questions were sent, or, you know, the question about the death penalty and Flint were essentially sent to Ms. Clinton beforehand. And within this larger narrative of, like, what happened after you became chair of the DNC, it still seems to me that you participated in this coronation of Hillary, that, like, we Democrats were completely denied a primary. I mean, say what we will about Donald Trump, but, like, 16 people stood on that stage and battled it out through 9 debates till the end. And in our case, you know, we had 3 candidates, one of whom never had a shot. And the person that did have a shot, essentially things were stacked and created in his way and stacked against him from the very beginning. So I'm happy we're having this conversation. I think we need to have this conversation to move forward. But I think it's really, really difficult for me to hear some of what you're saying in light of the fact that you participated at the very onset in essentially propping up Ms. Clinton without, you know, like, it just, I mean, someone, one person's going into the debate and knows the questions they're going to be asked. And I also thought it was interesting.
First of all, ma'am, I'm glad you raised that, because I addressed that in my book. And long before I wrote a book, I addressed it millions of times. I'm probably the only American who had his or her emails hacked that went out to explain what was hacked. Being hacked is a theft. And while we know who stole our emails and created this discord and weaponized them, no one has been brought to justice. In my book, I addressed that. I worked as a commentator for CNN. I was also vice chair of the party. And in both capacities, in the book, I explain it all, and I like to make it very plain and very clear so that it's in black and white. I said that throughout that time, when we were trying to expand the number of debates, remember the DNC had announced that they will host only 6 debates. Well, I was one of those DNC officers that moved to get more debates. And, of course, being with CNN, I also moved because CNN was willing to host those additional debates, town hall forums, and much, much more. And I said in the book, and I finally got a chance to be able to tell my truth in my book, where I explain everything about those so-called debate questions at the forums, town hall, et cetera. Here's the one thing I know, and you can call Bernie Sanders and you can find out, and Martin O'Malley and the rest. I talked to all of the candidates. And while only the emails that were so-called leaked about Hillary Clinton came out through WikiLeaks and Guccifer 2.0 and DC Leaks, et cetera, I talked to everyone. I made sure that they were aware, so they were not blindsided by what we were trying to do, that these difficult issues that we had not addressed in previous debates would be brought up in Flint, in Columbus, where we had the town hall forum. And so I apologize later for having what I said, some of my emails leaked so that you could not see others. But, you know, I was an activist. I was trying to get more debates. I was trying to get more things out there. It's not as if CNN wrote the questions and gave them to me. It's Donna Brazil doing what Donna Brazil enjoy doing, which is stirring it up and getting these topics to the candidates. And then one thing I need to tell you, Brian, every week before I went on ABC or CNN, I would get my topics, and if they involve the Republicans, I call them and say, guess what? I'm going to talk about your primary. I'm going to talk about Jeb Bush or, you know, Governor Walker, Governor Christie. I need to know what your thinking is. I need to give you heads up. And that's what I did. And again, I apologize because guess what? Once those emails went out, they were not my emails. They were John Podesta's. I couldn't confirm I couldn't verify if it was really John's email. John wasn't verifying it. But yet I had to explain to the American people, and Megyn Kelly and many others went after me, that the emails that were being leaked and weaponized were emails that belonged to me. I had no verification because my server, my DNC material was hacked. It was stolen. It was wiped clean. So I couldn't show, well, see, I gave this one to Bernie. I gave this one to Martin. I gave this to Jeb Bush. I gave this to Ted Cruz. So you know what I did as a good Catholic girl? I said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry because I cannot have something restored that was hacked.
But you're saying now you routinely gave questions or topics to people you were going to interview or be involved in debates with to have the most informed possible conversations. That's what you're saying.
Brian, at the time, I mean, I had to go back and let me tell you, I went back and I found emails between me and my bosses at CNN. I found emails between me and Roland Martin. I found emails between me and various other people in the Sanders campaign, the Clinton campaign. But when people came to me that night, I was in Georgia, and said, Donald, what about this email? I'm like, wait a minute, guys, I don't have it. I got to go home. I went standby, flew back to D.C., believing that maybe he's on my home machine. I had no reason to lie, because I knew what the truth was. But I could not produce any evidence of it, and that frustrated me. And it really made me sad. I mean, I talk about how sad I was because my integrity was at stake. I knew what I had done, and I knew Bernie well enough to know that he understood what I had done. I knew Hillary well enough to know that she understood what I had done, but I also knew what I had done. I knew as a Democratic Party operative who expanded the number of debates, who disbanded the town hall in form, at least I was an advocate for that. Black Lives Matter, people probably forgot about Black Lives Matter, but last year they were active. They wanted us to address these issues, and I did not want them to shut down another Democratic Party event because they feared that these questions would not be raised. And so I took it upon myself and working with diverse voices within the party to push these issues along. And again, it's not pretty when you're hacked. And the purpose of also writing this book, let me just put this out here. We were hacked. We were hacked by a foreign government who intended to hurt one of our candidates. That candidate happened to be Hillary Clinton. We were hacked, and it weakened our democracy at a time when we were in a very close election season. And most of the hack and most of the emails were aimed to try to sow discord within the Democratic Party, to destroy Hillary Clinton, to destroy the Democratic Party. And the other half of my book, we've talked about the first 10 chapters, Brian, but the other half of my book, and I hope your readers get a copy, it talks about what the Russians did to us and disseminating false information and creating this false narrative. And yes, I also believe that they propped up Donald Trump. And the media needs to take an examination of what they did and what they failed to do. Because last year I stopped talking to the press because all they wanted to talk about was those damn emails and not talked about the hacking, the harassment, and what we were going through as Democrats in our great country. We were attacked.
We have a few minutes left with Donna Brazile, whose new book is called Hacks: The Inside Story of the Break-Ins and Breakdowns That Put Donald Trump in the White House. Have you come to a conclusion for yourself about whether, without the Russian meddling, Hillary Clinton would have won?
You know, I think there are several different scenarios, but I do believe that the interference and the meddling caused us great harm in our country, and I'll tell you two reasons. One, the Russians just didn't go in and steal our emails and make us all look like fools. I mean, putting out somebody's recipe. The Russians interfere with our database. They harass and intimidated our donors. They harass what I like to often say, they also infiltrated some of our voting systems, our e-poll books, voter registration systems. So I think the jury is still out. I am waiting for Bob Mueller and the congressional investigators. If you want to know how I really feel, go back and look at all of my columns. I have been focused on what happened on Election Day since I left the DNC. I have never experienced an election. Remember, I have the experience of Campaign 2000 when we had the hanging chads and the swinging chads and all the mother pregnant chads. This was a and you won the Russians you won went the, after you won, our country.
You won the popular vote that time too.
Well, no, I know. I tell people I'm the Ernie Banks of politics. I have great statistics, but no championships. And I do have a lot of championships. But I'm back up at Harvard to figure out how to strengthen our democracy, how to restore faith in our democratic institutions, how to ensure that the Russians will not do to us in 2016 and 2018. I've been studying what happened in Germany and some of the other European countries. I'm working with Democrats and Republicans to come up with various tactics and techniques to train staffers so that we don't go through this again. And let me just say this. I am grateful once again to all of your listeners who not just supported Hillary or Bernie or whoever, but those who got out and voted last year. You're the hope of our country. You're the future of our country. And I want to encourage more young people to take their seats at the table. Yesterday was a great day. I feel like James Brown when he was singing, I feel good. I feel good that Democrats are coming back out of the wilderness.
Before we run out of time in about 2 minutes, I'm struck by two things about yesterday that aren't being talked about that much. Besides the governor races, 15 seats changing red to blue in the Virginia legislature, and the referendum in Maine, where people voted to join the Obamacare Medicaid expansion, which their Republican governor had declined to do. What do those two things tell you? And I saw Nicholas Kristof on TV last night, the New York Times columnist, suggest that Democrats get all kinds of progressive referenda up there for 2018, abortion rights, health care, assault weapons, to generate even more turnout. Like that idea?
I love that idea. You know, last night was one of those moments in my life when I just sit back and smile. This was not a victory of the top down. This was a victory of the bottom up. This is the bottom up. This is what grassroots politics is all about. People taking control of their own lives, going to the ballot box and saying, this is what I want. This is what we need. That's the power of the vote. That's the power of having people get out and participate. Brian, a few weeks ago, remember, I'm no longer the chair of the Democratic Party. I'm just an ordinary citizen, and yep, I care about my party, I care about my country, but a couple of weeks ago, I found myself in Northern Virginia. I woke up, what the hell am I doing? I'm 57 years old, I should be, you know, whatever. And I went out to Northern Virginia, and I was campaigning for a woman named Kathy Tran. Now, she was a great candidate, Asian American, and she wanted me to come out, and I said, yeah, I'll come out and do some canvassing. I did some canvassing, you know, another day for some other candidates. I went out to help Justin Fairfax. She won last night. She became the first Asian American ever to serve in the Virginia House of Delegates. Let me tell you something. There are days when we throw a little rock in the water and all of a sudden it has a ripple effect. These grassroots Democrats, the energy that you're seeing out there, that is not that energy will not only save the Democratic Party, it's going to save the United States of America. So I want to tell everybody who's out there, keep on keeping on because you are going to change America.
And we leave it there. With Donna Brazile.
Hacks, buy the book, it's great.
Hacks, the inside story of the break-ins and breakdowns that put Donald Trump in the White House. Donna Brazile, thank you so much for coming on with us.
Always a pleasure talking to you, and thank you to all your listeners.